know, doesn't have a car chase or special effects or anything like that. With adults, you know, where there's a kind of an old-fashioned love story and a lot of dialogue, I think represents some real risk-taking. Well, I came into it right away. The Kurt Ludtke, who you're going to talk to here, is from your field. He was a journalist, you know, for years with the Miami Herald and the editor-in-chief of both Miami Herald and then the Detroit Free Press. And when he did his first screenplay, I did the film that he did, which was Absence of Malice. We got to be close friends, and I think that picture was for him. You know, sort of on-the-job training experience because he had never done a screenplay before. He'd always wanted to do Out of Africa, I think. And after that picture, Frank Price, we did that picture for Frank, too. And you'll have to check these facts with Kurt. I don't know whether it was Frank's suggestion or Kurt's suggestion. The way I understand it, Frank wanted him to do another picture and said, was there a project that he particularly wanted to do? And I believe Kurt said that he'd always loved Out of Africa. While I was doing Tootsie, Kurt went off and wrote a screenplay for Out of Africa and then sent it to me primarily as a friend. I mean, he didn't send it to me and say, will you do Out of Africa? He sent it as a friend to say, you know, what do you think of this? And I made some notes and then agreed to talk to him about the picture. And it's sort of in the work process of doing the notes, which is the way you get hooked a lot anyway, I began, without knowing it, to start working on it with him. And we did the same thing that we did on Absence of Malice, which is I said, look, I'll work for nothing if you'll work for nothing for a few months and see if we can't get the draft a little closer to, you know, something we both feel we would want to do as a film. So 1983 was spent from February till the end of the year with Kurt doing two additional drafts on spec. He'd been paid for his first draft, but the picture hadn't moved further than that, hadn't been sent to anybody to do, and Frank knew it was in my hands. And so we did a second draft and then a third draft. And on the third draft, I felt it was getting close enough that it could perhaps be a film, and then committed to do the film. And then we spent all of 84 doing another four or five rewrites on the script, and my going to Africa and you know trying to set it up. So I came into it in February of 83. So it will be 3 years for me this coming February.
You've noted that it's not a linear narrative. It's not a story per se. So was that an intimidating thing right off the bat?
Well, if I don't know if there's anything in the press notes about it, but the history of this project has been very interesting. I mean, in the sense that it's a project that everybody has known about for a lot of years, and it's been a film possibility for maybe 20 years. Columbia Pictures owned it for 15 years, 16 years anyway. And everyone from Orson Welles to David Lean, Nick Rogue, I mean, people had thought about making it. Everybody was smart enough to know there were real pitfalls in it, you know, because it wasn't a story. The book itself, Out of Africa, if you ever get a chance to read it, and if you haven't, I would recommend it strongly, just as a pleasurable experience. It's a great, great book.
Well, I'm always surprised when it's called a novel, because it's not.
Well, it isn't a novel at all. It's a collection of memoirs, and it's not. There is no story whatsoever in it. There is not a single event that takes place. What it is a recollection of a country and a people and a very poetic, nostalgic look back at something very soulful and moving to her. And so everybody's thought, gee, what a wonderful arena to work in, but how do you solve it in terms of storytelling? What happened that we had that none of the other filmmakers who tried it had is that in 1980 or 81, may have been 81, Judith Thurman published an extensive and definitive biography called Isaac Dinesen, The Life of a Storyteller. There had been a previous biography that was just a lot of nonsense, you know, a kind of a puff piece about her. But Judith spent 8 years researching and working on this and finally wrote in 1981, this piece, Isaac Dinison, The Life of a Storyteller. Which book award? Not the National.
National Book Award.
And that, see, the thing that that one did is it told the truth about her life, and while it didn't give you a story, it at least gave you some events. Her planned marriage to the one brother instead of the other, the syphilis, the love affair with Finch Hatton, including an exchange of letters between them. You know, all of those things were in the book. So Kurt could use more than one piece of source material then.
And
so
also the piece on Dennis, right, was already out.
Silence Will Speak. Well, that had been out for a while, but that's not of much help, except... Well, it isn't, not because it's not a good book, it is, but, you know, he was such an elusive character that I think he eluded even the biographer. You know, you can read that book and you don't know, he's still a piece of thin air, you know, in a way.
I find it interesting, too, that apparently Jeremy Irons was very much interested in this role. I'm curious.
I think any Englishman would be interested in the role because he was an Englishman, uh-huh. You know. But you see... I think he was an optical illusion. I mean, literally, an optical illusion. This as a character, I mean. By that, I mean, I pored over every historical document. It's not the only... There's another book called West with the Night by a woman named Beryl Markin, in which she talks about Dennis Finch Hatton. Finch Hatton was a crazy, enigmatic, elusive, private character who was really wildly romanticized by these women. And... he was air, you know. You can't get a hold of him in any way. And my problem was not to present the literal truth, but to present the truth as she saw it. In other words, I was trying to give the audience a sense of how this man was idealized by this woman, not what he really was. I wasn't doing a documentary on Dennis Finch Hatton, but a love story, because she was obsessive about him. If you read her letters, not the book. In the book, right. She barely mentions him. You know, she's very discreet. But, I mean, she was obsessed with this man because she couldn't have him. Nobody could have him. You know, he was there and he disappeared. He was there and he disappeared. And so I kept seeing Redford, you know. And I couldn't see any value that would deepen the story if he was English or French or Italian or American. In other words, to me, it didn't have anything to do with being English. It had to do with a character quality of this elusiveness, this sort of private, extremely individualistic guy who, you know, he was the utopian individualism. You know, he left society and went to the wilderness where he didn't have to be beholden to anybody, you know, and he came and went as he wanted to. And for me, that was much more easily playable on screen with someone like Redford than any other actor I could think of.
And ironically enough, it's Streep sometimes has been cast in that kind of a role, the elusive persona. Here, it's against that.
Well, you know, the thing was, I thought a long time about, does it have to be English? Does it have to be English?
Didn't he start
English?
Was he going to do a British accent?
Well, yeah, here's what happened. When we first just talked about doing the part, we talked at length about, should he play this English? And, you know, we fell into that trap, too, of, well, he was English, so let's play him English. And then the more we worked on the English, the more I started saying, hey, Bob, what will make this a better movie if you speak with an English accent? I mean, in what way will it be a better love story, a clearer picture of freedom versus obligation, which is thematically what it's about, a more wistful memoir, a more soulful movie? All it is excess baggage. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody was sitting there saying, oh, look, Robert Redford speaking with an English accent. Hot dog. And, you know, and all that'll do is get in the way. So he worked real hard on the accent, and we even did some tests on film, and he was terrific at it. But I for the life of me, kept saying, this is a mistake. And, you know, Bob could have gone either way. He said, I don't know. You know, you can't judge by me. I don't know. I'll do it if you want me to do it. I'll be a lot more comfortable not doing it, you know, but I'll do it if you want me to do it. So I was real ambivalent right down to the first shooting day. I mean, I didn't really make a decision until we got on the set. And then I said, Jesus, I think all it is a trick. I mean, what's better? There's nothing, I can't think of one thing that's better except that some literary critics will say, ha ha, he's not English, you know. But But it, you know, we can be absolutely as true. If you were playing an aide to Churchill in World War II, you would have to be English, you know. But for this particular story, everybody was in Africa in 1913. The English were the colonizers there, but there were Americans. The Belknap, the guy that ran the farm, too, was American. There were Indians. There was everybody. So it wasn't anachronistic socially to have a guy who was American there. I just eliminated any statement about where he was from. He did not speak, if you'll notice, with the rural sound that he sometimes can have. I mean, we cleaned up his English so it was educated and literary and correct English. The syntax was all, there weren't a lot of contractions, and there weren't a lot of rural sounds. But beyond that, it just felt better to me without the accent. So I'll take the blame for that.
You know, three actors, very all strong personalities all, and seemingly three that perhaps work in different ways, so I'm including Branagh in this also. Was that difficult for you as a director? What did you?
No, not really. I mean, it's very rare that you get more than one actor at a time in a picture that works exactly the same way. I mean, everybody has their own background and training and idiosyncrasies, and you get quite used to that after a while of because they do all three work quite differently.
Was there any
Frank and I had long talks, and as a matter of fact, we debated at length about whether to do this with stars or to just go and, you know, find a Danish actress, you know, a Swedish actress, or, you know, and an English guy, the really good actors, and try to make it for less money. But the problem is you couldn't make it for much less money anyway. It was really an expensive picture physically. So at the last minute we decided that, you know, Meryl would be... The key was her, really. The key was who's going to play Isaac Dennison. Who's going to get this on screen, feeling...
Did you have any reluctance to do a part that was really... I mean, it is secondary role, absolutely, although from the TV edge, you certainly
absolutely secondary. He knows that. He was terrific about it. If anything, he wanted less rather than more. You know, he knew, as I knew, that we would destroy the picture if we tried to build his part up. You couldn't do it. You know, you'd just be inflating be inflating it artificially. No, that wasn't any problem for him.
Do you have any objections to the TV ads, which are showing him as being...
I personally, and I've gone on record, you know, as saying this, think that it's slightly misleading. But the fact is that even the reviews that we've gotten so far do say that the heart of the picture is the love story. Yeah. And so it's not a lie to say it's a love story. It's just that if a bunch of Robert Redford fans come expecting to see the Sundance Kid, that's not what they're going to see. You know what I mean? It's not his picture. It's her picture. And I don't think this picture would work without him. I mean, I have no doubt in my mind about saying that. But it's her picture. I don't think I could have gotten the love story to work as the pivotal event in the picture without him, you know, because I think you, just because of the collection of all the roles he's played and what we suspect about him from what we read about him as a man, Redford, he fits that persona better than anybody I could think of, you know, this sort of unhavable, unattainable, elusive, romantic figure. And so I don't feel bad about saying that, A, it's a love story, and it's a love story between the two of them. I wish that there was a way, and we tried in the ads, to present more of the sense that it's this woman's story. But it's very hard to do that. I mean, I've never done a film in my life where it's so hard to do clips, for example. I have to do these television shows. No, you know what I mean? Where I can't find a clip that shows the picture. You know, try to think. What would you do? You'd either do... There are terrific scenes between her and Bob, and that's what we're using as clips. But, I mean, what do you do? Show one of those montages where her voiceover is talking? And you're going to say, what the hell is this movie? You know, it's very hard to find a...
Well, I kind of built it up on TV as sort of the...
You know what advertising is like. It's not just the movies.
Sure.
It's the same... You know, they'll tell you that you'll grow to be 8 feet tall if you use certain toothpaste or something, too. You know, I mean, that's advertising.
And while we're with... Excuse me. You said in an earlier interview that you were somewhat concerned about the film's narrative drive and holding the audience's attention. Do you still feel that way?
Well, I'm very pleasantly surprised that it's too early to tell. You can't know how many screenings. We've had 25 screenings and, you know, one premiere. We have another one to go. I wouldn't say that the jury's in by any means yet, but the reactions that we've had so far have been surprisingly positive, specifically in terms of the length. You know what I mean? In other words, I was petrified that you couldn't sustain a picture this long without a narrative drive. You know, without a what happens next, and then what happened, and then what happened, and then what happened, because it's basically character and rhythms and moods and emotions. And it doesn't seem to be bothering people. Sure, it's bothering some people, there's no question. But percentage-wise, the majority are quite willing to sit there and enjoying the picture and not complaining about, well, there's no story to it. You know, it doesn't have story. I mean, we're not getting people running out and saying, well, it doesn't have any story. And that was what did worry me. I thought, you know, people would worry about... I did one other film like this that I worried the same way, and that worked very well, and that was Jeremiah Johnson, which was essentially moods and rhythms and feelings. In the latter half, there was a kind of a melodrama with him fighting the Indians, but for the first hour and 20 minutes of the movie, there really was nothing but episodic little developments and things, very much like this picture stylistically. You know, it was a style movie of moods. And they're always the most difficult. I mean, the opposite extreme for me would be something like 3 Days of the Condor or Tootsie, where it's all narrative drive. You know, he comes back, they're dead, he's got to hide, you know what I mean?
Why did you decide to do a piece of...
I didn't sit down and say, I'm going to do a 2-hour and 25-minute movie.
Well,
but
even in editing...
This is just my opinion now. And I'm not being facetious with you. I'm serious. I'm saying I sat there and tried to cut this movie. I mean, don't think I wanted to release... First of all, we lose 2 shows a day. That's serious money.
Yeah.
And that's not... You're not talking about peanuts here. You're talking about millions of dollars. So it's not a cavalier decision on my part to leave it at this length. This picture is... a series of pebbles dropped in the water that send ripples down, and then the payoff at the end are the ripples from those. Everything is in sets or pairs. She gets thrown out of the bar in the beginning. She gets toasted at the end. Now I can lift that pair out, okay? I can lift Kin and Jui out of the picture completely, the old chief with the earlobes, but then I lose the sense of Africa. See, in other words, I couldn't find any blocked section that only stood by itself, that didn't have any consequence at the end. I went through every single scene up front and said, could I take just that scene out? But what would happen is you couldn't take just that out. If you're going to take that out, then you've got to take 2 other pieces out later on. And the payoff of the picture, if the picture seems to work at all, has something to do with your feeling at the end of it. Of this loss, this sense of loss, which for me came from the book, really. In other words, when I finished reading the book, I had such a sense of sort of bittersweet loss that I had lived a life, really, and seen a place and a country through the eyes of this incredible woman. And I kept thinking, how do I get that on film? Because I don't have her prose. And the only way I could do it was to make it as full as possible. I mean, one of the pluses for me is that it isn't just she and Redford. She has a real relationship with her husband.
Well,
and that needs
Brandauer,
time.
Brandauer.
And he's wonderful in it. And to me, that makes it a richer film. In other words, she doesn't have one man in her life. She doesn't exist with nothing, and then Redford shows up, and then the picture happens. I mean, she's got a life. She tries to make it work. And I had to invest the time on screen with the Brandauer relationship, because one of the richest things to me is when he asks for the divorce and she says, how do you manage it to keep us friends? And he says, we started that way. You get an arc and a completion. You get what I call a closure of a circle, you know, that's been set in motion that closes up at the end. And so I wrung my hands plenty trying to cut this thing down. You know.
When do you start feeling...
Any director who tells you that he's not a nervous wreck at this time, and this is the worst time in the world for a director, there's nothing I can do. That's why it's worse. When I'm making the picture, I'm a nervous wreck, but I can do something. I can try to keep working on it. When I'm cutting it, I'm a nervous wreck, but I can do something. But you know, there's a wonderful article in this Sunday's New York Times about Spielberg. in which the opening sentence is Steven Spielberg was pacing the room cracking walnuts, saying, look at me, I'm cracking walnuts, I'm a nervous wreck. Now, this is Steven Spielberg, right? There's nobody been more successful in the world, but this because he's going through the same thing I'm going through now. This is like waiting in the waiting room when your wife is going to have a baby. You know, it's like a cliche joke about famous nervous men pacing in the waiting room because they can't do anything. You know, there's this baby getting born, and anything could go wrong, and there's nothing you can do. So, I mean, I've done everything I can do, right? I took the print to the premiere, wet, from Technicolor, you know, and that's it. I'm here, you know. I'm nervous.
But do you...
It's not important to me, but it's important in this sense. This is a film which is not like the rest of the films that have been made this year. It's a bit of a gamble. It's an expensive film. It's not the kind of film that's been making money. I want there to be a chance to make more films like this film. And if this film isn't successful, it will mean there won't be a chance to make more films like this. So I'm very nervous about the fact, and this film doesn't have to be a blockbuster. I don't care that it's a blockbuster, and I don't care that it wins 27 Academy Awards. I just want it to be well enough accepted that there'll be room in the marketplace for other pictures like it. So we won't get stuck with a film industry where there's only one kind of a movie that you can make.
Are you saying that riding on this film is at least the immediate future of the commercial feature as you see it?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm not... You're saying it. I'm not. I'm saying that I think that it's important for... It's important for a film like this to do at least well enough to encourage other films like it to be. When I say like it, I don't mean to compare it qualitatively, but just in terms of the fact that it deals with issues that are relatively adult, and we are always saying that the marketplace is kids, you know, for movies, and that that's been the big market certainly all summer, and those have been very good pictures, but it's not the whole picture. I would love to see that you could do all kinds of pictures, and since this is a risky one, I'd love to see it do well. So sure, I'm nervous about that.
As you were taking this on, you must have been...
With a picture of this size, there are just tremendous logistic problems to begin with. I don't think any... those problems don't worry me as much because they're humanly solvable in a way. You know, that's like an equation. You say, how do I move 250 people where there's no road into a place where I have to have a road? You know, if you get a bunch of people that are smart in a room, you can say, well, we can pick up the stones because there's not a lot of heavy equipment there. We can fly in. We can make a landing strip. We can do it. In other words, those are solvable things. It would be intangible things were the much more difficult. Is there any way I can put this novel, this not a novel, but this memoir, they call it a novel, on screen and have people watch what seems to be an apparently narrativeless film and feel satisfied at the end? It was the creative challenge that was more frightening, if you will, or more intimidating than the physical one. The physical challenges are always solvable. They just take work. You know, you say, how are you going to get the lion to charge the guy when, you know, we can't touch the lions over there? And you know, can I put Redford actually standing there with a lion? Because otherwise it'll look like a trick if I don't tie up Redford with the lion. And those are real problems, okay? But they're solvable. You get an animal guy, you get Redford, you get a good gun guy, and you get the lion trainer, and you say how, you know, and you work it out. It takes a long time, and it's a pain in the ass, and you screw it up a bunch of times, and you pull your hair out, and you say, I'll never work with animals again, or whatever. But you can get that done. The bigger challenge is creating the emotional result, I guess. I wanted people to feel at the end of the movie the way I felt at the end of the book. That was a wonderful feeling. And I had to find a way with Kurt Ludtke, who really solved the bulk of this, because he did a beautiful screenplay. I mean, a lot of people try to do this screenplay. He's not the first. He's about the fifth or sixth, and nobody's been able to do it, you know. And so that was the real challenge for me.
What about, we have to move on.
Visual... because that's the vocabulary I was working with, what she did in her writing. I tried to find her rhythm, you know, her style and her rhythm. And I tried to set it right at the beginning with the repeat of that line, I had a farm in Africa at the foot of the Ngong. I had a farm in Africa. I had a farm in Africa. It would sort of tell you that it's a rhythm thing. Geez, somebody really is a sketch. Is that you?
I'm going to hope to get a signature from you in a second. Go ahead.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's all.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'm taking care of them enough.
Can you tell us a little bit about your modus operandi and how do you prepare an accent like you prepare so well?
Well, thanks. But I had a tape of Karen Blixen that was made, a videotape that was made in the 50s when she visited this country, the only time she ever did. She was very old, and she was really very sick. The advanced stages of syphilis and all of its complications. So she looked about 100 years old. And she also, there were a lot of things that were very telling about it, even though she was, it wasn't the age that I was going to be in the movie. She was very stylish. She was very self-aware. And her voice was completely distinctive. And so I was able to listen to that and copy her, you see. I had to bring it way, way, way down from the way that she really spoke, which was incredibly grand. I mean, it was great fun, and I wanted to do it that way. And Sydney said, no, people will go crazy, you know.
It must be a very important priority for you, the vocal part of your acting.
Well, when you're playing a real person, though, I had to speak like her. And I had a tape of Karen Silkwood, a telephone tape that was really quite distorted. So I listened to that when I was doing Silkwood. Yeah, when you're playing a real person, it would feel queer to me not to.
In fact, we were talking earlier about the fact that it eventually was the decision to leave Redford's voice alone, pretty much.
Yeah.
Your accent.
Who did you talk to already?
Mr. Pollack.
Oh.
And I guess that was a decision that was very late in coming, what finally to do about the voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, I don't know, they had their go-around about that over and over and over. Basically, Sidney was very clear in his mind almost on every other point of this movie. As I see it now, as it's done, it's really what he had in mind. I mean, and that's a great tribute to not only his vision, but his tenacity, because he got what he wanted. But the one thing that he hadn't been ever, ever sure of was whether Redford should change the way he spoke or not. He never was sure of it going into the movie. And that's why they had that sort of 11th hour decision.
And speaking of preparations, what was your sense of what Karen Blixen was all about, either from reading Out of Africa or other materials or your own exposure to her? What kind of a person did you assess her to be in preparing your own approach?
What kind of a person?
Tough woman, vulnerable, a dreamer?
Well, she, you know, she wrote about herself voluminously, and so...
Somewhat reticently at times, though.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't found that to be the case. I mean, in her letters.
In the letters, okay.
She had a lot of time during the rainy season to explore what she really felt. All alone, too. So she sort of performed this self-analysis, and it was incredibly valuable for me. Of course, when people write about themselves, they lie like crazy, too, so things were very contradictory from one day to the next, if she was feeling good about herself or if she was feeling lack of confidence, you know. To me, those inconsistencies were the things that made me understand her, because I'm hugely inconsistent and It always disconcerts me when someone says, you know, in 1978, you said in an interview in Playgirl magazine that you felt... And I didn't feel that way Thursday, you know? And maybe I do today, who knows? It's just... So her inconsistency interested me. But she was a very vivid character. What I liked about her was that she thought she knew herself, and she was a less, torn-up, neurotic character than others that I've played. She was sort of mature in her needs and her greed and her greediness for experience and life and her vulnerability. I mean, I understood her. She was sort of complete. She knew herself, and that was something I liked about her.
Was it kind of a relief to play someone who was...
Yes, she was more womanly than a lot of characters I play. I mean, womanly in the sense that she was complete. She knew herself, and whatever her problems were, she sort of said, fuck it, this is the way I am, take it or leave it, and I liked that about her.
Did she really jump at this role? I mean, was this something, it seems like something someone would really want to do.
Yes, I really tried to get it. I mean, Sydney sort of dandled me for a while before he let me know that I could play it. So I was very anxious to play it.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm the only one naive enough to think that if you want a role, that almost assures you will get that role.
Oh, you know, there's a catch-22. If you're well-known enough, they think, well, you know, another Meryl Streep movie, or, oh, I know what it's going to be like, or, I don't want Sophie's Choice here, you know, or I don't want... So he had felt maybe he wanted someone unknown. Same thing that Alan Bakula felt. Also, when you come in with this, you know, sort of big reputation, directors think, oh, you know, well, I'm going to have to tangle with this enormous ego and the whole thing. So, there's a lot, you have to bend over backwards and say, look, I'm on your side, let's all make this movie, I'm not going to... So, there's that. People want something new, too, in a part, they just...
What criteria do you use when you're trying to...
You never get to ask anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You know, Cincinnati folks are so shy.
Not what I know.
I was just going to ask, isn't this fairly unusual for you to be meeting the press like this? I shouldn't say unusual, but why are you meeting with this and talking with this? Do you feel a special need for this film, or a series of disappointments perhaps with... other films or whatever?
Well, see, I work a lot. So if I was out chatting with everybody on every movie, everybody would be... So I've tried not to be all over the place all the time.
I see.
Even though I work a lot. I think it's boring for people to hear, you know, the same old opinions from the same old actors. So I like this movie. I'm in a good mood. It's Christmas. Don't push me.
What criteria do you use when you're selecting a role for yourself? I mean, you must have a lot. Even if you don't get everything, you must have a lot of choices offered to you.
Yeah, but there isn't much. I mean, depends on the month you're looking. You know what's around. Lots of times. There isn't a lot of stuff. This year there were, but you don't get offered all these, I mean, wonderful parts. They don't... People produce their own movies now, and every movie that you see, every woman's part that you see, was not at one time available to every actress that's on the horizon. There are all sorts of different ways that things are born, and associations between people, producers or directors who want to work with somebody. And, you know, it's the way I usually choose things is I just read the scripts that are available at any given time, And the ones that I think are the best, I take. You know, and but I'm not by any means. I mean, I know there's a presumption that I get offered everything, but that's not true.
Do you ever worry that you need to take, say, a more commercial role or something? I mean, you do seem to get the best roles and strongest roles of people like the character in Plenty and stuff, but often those, you know, people don't really relate favorably to those characters. And
12 people go see those movies, you know. So I'm not really overexposed when I'm in
it. Well, do you ever think maybe you should, I don't know,
do a big commercial movie?
Or, you know, a slapstick movie or something like that. I don't know, something completely commercial.
You know, I think that all the time, but I don't really like a lot of them. So I like that. I think they're okay. And then the point in the movie when I go as an audience, I don't want to be in that position on the screen, do you know what I mean? I don't want that directed at me. In other words, there's nothing worse than a comedy that goes where something else, in a drama, there's an engine usually working, and you can, expositional stretches you can usually get through, but, I mean, I've been in lots of comedies on stage, and when they don't work, it's excruciating. I'm not the greatest judge of characters, of scripts, the character of a script when I read them, especially funny stuff. Also I'm one of these people, I sit in the movie theater and everybody's screaming with laughter. And a lot of stuff I think is just garbage. So I can't be in it if I feel that way.
What's the payoff for you? It sounds like you do the work for the work, and it's not really that important.
Well, I get a little money, too.
Well, yeah, of course, but what is the, what is the reward for you? Is it the
work? Well, there's a great satisfaction in when it comes out well. And if it doesn't, at least it was something that engaged me on a level that was interesting and I enjoyed it. I mean, I'm very fortunate, I know, to be in this line of work that is constantly interesting, if it's not constantly successful. You know, so some of the bigger commercial things, too, I'm not the type either. You know, they really need somebody for a lot of big commercial movies of a different type in the female department, so, they don't immediately think of me. Yes. I think Heartburn will probably be pretty commercial, because it's pretty funny. I just finished making that. But, that was,
Well, we can talk about a street persona, but yet in two pictures now, certainly, Falling in Love and this one, your character is very vulnerable and very needing. You're not eating people alive and spitting them out. You're a very caring, sharing person, mm-hmm. I think, in both of those pictures. So do you like that part of a role? Do you like that aspect of a character, too?
I don't ever look at it that way. Falling in Love I wanted to make because it was, Bobby and Ulu. And,
anyway, tell us about Africa. Any surprises about Africa for you? Had you expected something you did not find over there, or vice versa?
Yeah, I did. I expected Africa to be much more like what we see on the television, sub-Sahara, extreme poverty and desolation, and the West African version of Africa, which is thick jungle and snakes from every tree and huge apes. So I didn't know that it was going to be like it was when we flew into Nairobi. Nairobi looks like, someplace, I said to the last group, so I'm just, it's not an original answer, but it was my first impression. It looks like Zurich. You know, it's very flat and there's a lot of high rises and it's all white and sparkly. And just around the environs of the town, there's this huge shanty town kind of very, very poor tin shacks, but it didn't look like, just physically, it didn't look like what I thought it would. And then we drove about 20 minutes out of town, and it looks like Devon in England. It's rolling, grassy hills, and horse farms, and large, stately trees, like the where they were having that Gymkhana, that horse show and film. That was about, you know, 4 minutes from where we were living. It really looks like that. It looks like England. Then you drive 10 minutes away from there, and it's salt flats and just completely wild. I mean, it was so changeable. It was so varied what the place was like that I was unprepared for. I really loved it there, and it got a great grip on my heart, the place. Much more than I thought it would. I was very upset to leave there, and so were my husband and my kids, even though we were there for 6 months, and I thought, oh boy, how will we ever stand being 6 months out of New York? And well, it turned my head around and made me realize New York is not the only place. And oh, you know, she says if you live there, you'll always come back, even though she never did. Karen Blixen. But you feel that way about it.
I've been designated, I think, to ask all the stupid questions, so I'll go ahead and ask another one. It's often been said.
We drew lots.
Yeah. that one of the things about your acting that draws, well, our persona that draws people into the screen is it seems like in every scene, every camera angle, your face changes somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Is that but I mean, just in terms of, I guess, a coloration or whatever, but it's, I guess.
Well, Nestor Almendros, who's photographed me a lot, told me that. He said, you know, your face is very changeable.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you mean lumpy? He said, yes. But he said, it's interesting for a cinematographer to light, you know. It's fun for him. It must be fun for him because he's done 5 movies that I can't imagine anything more boring than looking at the same face, you know, through a thing. But he has not gotten sick of it yet. So he said that. But I don't know. I mean, I haven't gotten that far outside myself to be able to answer it.
When did you first learn of Karen Blixen?
Years ago, I don't remember when.
Mm-hmm. But it was long before
this
was ever a possibility.
Mm-hmm. And I must say, when I read it, I didn't, even though it's written in the first person and everything, I didn't really picture her at all. She was just sort of a voice that was telling me, opening the door to this landscape and these people. I didn't have any idea of what she was like or interested. Was only, and that's probably why when the project came up that that I was interested in going to the place and not necessarily playing the person. So then when I did some research and read my Bible was Judith Thurman's book.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beautifully written book. It really is entertaining besides just being a great source book for the character. And the more I read, the more interested I became in her. And then the person began to overwhelm what she'd written in my mind and her own personal story and her own, the character herself became more compelling than anything that she wrote in a funny way for me.
I think your scenes with Brandauer are very delicious. Could you tell us about working with him?
Well, yeah, I mean, people were asking me if Sydney and I, you know, what problems did you have? Sydney and I never had any problems, and I was just trying to rack my brains. I went home and asked Don, and I said, you know, when did I come home and bitch
sure
about,
that we had problems.
Bitch about Sydney, you know? And he says, you didn't. You didn't. Sydney was so busy bitching about Klaus. See, because they were at loggerheads almost the whole time. They fought on every inch of the thing. Always tickles me so much when you go and see a movie. It looks like everybody's in on the same secret, you know? But because I agree with you, I like the way those scenes play. But that was like splitting hairs, because Klaus and Sydney disagreed on the way that the character should be. Huh? Oh, God, it was round one, he won. Round two, he won, you know. I was just thinking, oh, my God, come on, boy.